From WBUR in Boston, I'm Karen Given, and this is NPR's sports program, Only a Game. What happens when an NBA player switches allegiances and signs with a rival team? Well, for one, his younger sister needs time to adjust.
It was, like, very emotional. I think I kind of cried a bit, actually.
This week on Only a Game, how Al Horford's sister, Anna, is surviving her brother's move to the 76ers. Plus, Joey Mellows, a.k.a. the Baseball Brit, quit his job to spend the summer of 2019 watching baseball. What did he learn?
I don't think I learned anything, really. I wish Karen had something deep and meaningful to say, but at the end of the day, it's just an idiot watching baseball for a summer.
I stand corrected. Stay with us. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Next week, one of the NBA's fiercest rivalries will be on display as the Boston Celtics host the Philadelphia 76ers in their final regular season matchup. Reporter Josh Swartz has the story of a fan who's found herself at the center of that rivalry.
The story of Anna Horford and the Boston Celtics community is a love story. And this love story involves heartbreak. So let's get that out of the way right at the start.
Five-time All-Star Al Horford has agreed to a four-year, $109 million deal with the 76ers.
Whoa!
On June 30th, 2019, right before the official start of NBA free agency, All-Star Al Horford shocked the NBA community. He decided to leave the Boston Celtics and sign with their bitter rivals, the Philadelphia 76ers. A panel of ESPN analysts found out about it on live TV.
This is amazing, right? How did this not get out, Ramona?
Well, Anna Horford, Al's younger sister by 6 years, was also surprised. She had gotten the news a little earlier in a group text with all five of the Horford siblings.
And that was that. And at first, I didn't even believe it. I thought he was just joking.
After the initial shock wore off, some other emotions set in.
I was literally so heartbroken. I think I tweeted about being heartbroken and that I needed like a minute or like 2 days to kind of process everything. It was like very emotional. I think I kind of cried a bit, actually. It was just like saying goodbye to like your first love or something, you know? It was like a whirlwind experience.
Anna's love affair with the Boston Celtics was far from preordained. She rarely watched the NBA growing up in Grand Ledge, Michigan, and she definitely didn't have any rooting interests. She was way more interested in getting her brother's attention.
Al was viewed more of, like, as the dad. He was, like, the protective older brother. The younger siblings, since we were so much younger than him, we'd be like, no, Al, stay in, you know, and play with us. Or like, let's go play baseball in the backyard. And he'd be like, okay, fine.
What about you? What role do you play in that family dynamic?
I think I'm just like the really like obnoxious, opinionated one where my siblings are like, okay, calm down.
For Anna and her siblings, basketball was always lurking on the periphery. Their dad, Tito Horford, played professionally in the late 80s, early 90s. He was the first ever Dominican-born NBA player. But if her dad's career influence wasn't enough, his genetic influence was. Anna's 6 feet tall, the shortest of all her siblings. And she did play until she blew out her knee in early high school, at which point she fully embraced her role as spectator. When Al won back-to-back NCAA championships at the University of Florida, Anna was right there cheering him on. The Atlanta Hawks took Al with the third overall pick in the 2007 NBA draft. And despite a bad 37-45 record his first season, they snuck into the playoffs as an 8 seed. Their reward? Opening on the road in the raucous, foggy TD Garden, home of the top-seeded Boston Celtics.
Fog in the building right now just gives a terrific effect here.
Like the old Madison Square Garden.
It is. I expect to see some guy in a felt hat with a cigar in his mouth.
I don't know. I think I started to pay attention to Boston around then because Al was so new to the league. And he had got into it with, like, Paul Pierce, that series.
The Seas went on to win the series and then the championship. Al Horford spent 8 more long seasons with the Hawks, Anna was growing restless.
It was difficult because we do so well. I mean, Al never missed the playoffs ever playing there, and we would do so well. I mean, we had gone to the Eastern Conference Finals, and it was like there were still empty seats.
Anna did everything in her power to fill the void. She enthusiastically supported Al on the court and fiercely defended him off of it. Like in the spring of 2016, some Cleveland Cavs fans were insulting Al on Twitter and tagged Anna. But they referred to her as Al's wife, not his sister. Though somewhat flattered she had been confused for Al's wife, Amelia, a former Miss Universe, Anna responded creatively.
He's my brother. I know that kind of thing is allowed in Ohio, but it's frowned upon in most other places. They did not appreciate that very much at all, even though it was just a joke, obviously.
Roasting people on NBA Twitter became part of Anna's brand. And it wasn't just fans. NBA refs weren't safe. Neither were the players. Draymond Green, J.R. Smith, Matthew Dellavedova, LeBron James. They all became targets of Anna's ire at one time or another. And while insulting people online since 2006 might as well be Twitter's unofficial slogan, Anna dishes out burns with finesse, like a social media Sun Tzu.
What does Al make of your outspokenness?
I think he ignores it. And he knows how I am naturally. Like, this is who I am as a person. And I think that he respects that.
But Anna didn't respect the Hawks fan base. She knew Al deserved better. She had seen better. Every empty seat at a Hawks game was a reminder of the atmosphere in Boston during that wild Hawks-Celtics playoff series in 2008, when the seeds of Anna's fan base crush had been planted. It turned out Anna's brother shared her feelings.
He was like, it is one of the most challenging places to play at is TD Garden. And he's like, I would love to be on the other side of that.
And then in the summer of 2016.
The announcement is that we're welcoming Al Horford and his family to Boston and looking forward to the future. Welcome, Al. Welcome your family, Amelia and Ian.
Little did Celtics owner Whit Grousbeck know, Boston should have been welcoming more than just Al, his wife, and his son. Soon, Anna would leave her mark in a major way. 2 months into his Boston tenure, Al missed a regular season game in November to attend the birth of his second child. Radio host Mike Felger had this to say.
Al Horford, your $30 million man, however much you pay him a year, sat out tonight because he had a birth of his kid.
Yep.
Was it yesterday?
Yesterday, yes.
Yesterday. He had the birth of his kid in Atlanta. The game was in Miami.
Nothing wrong with that.
I know when you make $30 million a year, it ain't much to get a private jet. Wick would probably pick it up. I would have gone to the game. I would have played the game. And I like my guys to sort of forsake everything for the team.
I mean, you're the ultimate.
And Al's like, this is like my daughter, my child, my first daughter. Of course, I'm not going to miss her birth.
So Anna did what she's always done when someone crosses a line with her family. She sprung into action, firing off a tweet before going to sleep.
I think I said something like, well, Mike Felger can just F the F off, or something like that.
What Anna didn't realize at the time was that Mike Felger is a longtime Boston sports media villain. A quick search of his name surfaces results like airing of grievances against Mike Felger, rant against Mike Felger, and even more concisely, Mike Felger sucks.
And then everyone was like, oh my God, you just called out Mike Felger. I was like, I don't know who the F Mike Felger is.
People loved Anna's takedown. It went viral on Celtics Twitter. And when she woke up the next morning and saw all the attention, she tweeted again, quote, apparently a lot of you guys dislike Mike Felger. Look at us all bonding over unlikable people. Her comments made the rounds on all the Celtics blogs. Soon, there were write-ups about it in Sports Illustrated and Bleacher Report.
And then I think that's when, like, the Boston fan base kind of started to really approach our family and whatnot, when they were like, oh, these people don't mess around.
Celtics fan cult hero status unlocked. Part of her appeal was how different she was from her brother. Here's Celtics beat writer Jared Weiss of The Athletic.
Yeah, it's like comparing fire and water. I mean, Al is this incredibly pensive, notable presence within a room. He speaks more with his body language and with his eyes than he does with his words. And Anna loves to talk. And I mean, Anna's energy is, you know, you could feel it whether it's in a tweet, whether she's in the room, she's you know, a very loud personality.
Even though Al was beloved by the Boston community, he was tight-lipped, especially with the media. Meanwhile, Anna was handing out uncensored commentary like candy.
She grew in the city into something that was impactful. Like, she was a part of the Celtics experience, she was a part of the Boston sports fan experience, and she was just a part of, like, kind of the social scene and entertainment of Boston experience, which I think has really transformed over the past, you know, 5 years or so.
She started off as Al Horford's sister, but ultimately people just knew her as Anna, which is what made the summer of 2019 especially hard.
Five-time All-Star Al Horford has agreed to a four-year, $109 million deal with the 76ers.
Whoa. Al's first game as a member of the 76ers was October 23rd, 2019. Their opponent, the Boston Celtics. Anna was watching from her mom's house in Michigan.
It was just weird. It was bizarre. It was just, I don't know, I don't even know how to explain it. It just didn't feel right.
Anna was still loved by the Celtics fan base, but now her brother was playing for another team. Was she going to stay loyal to the Celtics or try to bond with a new fan base? All day, Celtics and Sixers fans argued in her Twitter mentions about which team she should be rooting for.
And that was literally it. I felt like a mom with her two children who hated each other and just wanted to beat the crap out of each other. And I was like, okay, kids, well, you know, we're not going to go get candy if you don't shut up.
Anna's been vocal about her continued affection for the Celtics. Philadelphia fans have also been vocal, demanding she declare her allegiance to her brother's team. More importantly, though, they also want her to denounce his former team.
It's just silly. It's like if you fell out with your ex, but you guys were still on good terms, like your new significant other being like, hey, tell them they're a piece of shit. Like, just say it. Just say it, you know? And it's like, I'm not going to say it because I don't feel like that.
So things are complicated. For the first time ever, supporting her brother and the team she loves no longer mean the same thing.
I think she realized, like, this is a family.
Kwani A. Lunis is the social media coordinator for NBC Sports Boston.
The Celtics will always have my back. The Celtics fans will always have my back. So Sixers fans aren't proud of it, but that's how families are.
When I spoke to Anna, she hadn't been to a Sixers home game. At least, not yet.
Even with the C's, like, that came in time. So I think that they just need to give me some time to, like, get comfortable and process. And I have enough love in my heart for both. I don't want to choose. Like, I want to support both teams.
Sports fans aren't known as masters of nuance or compromise. But if anyone can motivate rival fan bases to find common ground, if anyone can become that common ground, Anna Horford has a pretty good shot. And besides, love is complicated.
That's reporter Josh Swartz. I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know. After 16 seasons in the NFL, Eli Manning has announced his retirement, and that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder and by The Athletic's Michael Lee. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Charlotte, tell us about the lesser of the Manning brothers.
Wow. Well, that's sort of how everybody's been thinking about Eli. He's retiring at 39. He holds almost every passing record in Giants history. He beat Tom Brady and the Patriots in 07 and 11, which I don't like to think about as a Pats fan. To me, Eli doesn't exist. But he is a two-time Super Bowl winner and MVP, seventh all-time in passing yards in the NFL, four-time Pro Bowler. But there's been some debate among fans online and some members of the media about whether he's, quote, good, because he's had some pretty not great regular seasons. I think that he's had a really impressive career, and it's just funny to me to see how obsessed people get with defining what it means to be the elite of the elite athletes.
Charlotte, it's hard because this conversation is now two Pats fans and one very, very not Pats fan.
Very.
Michael?
I do hate the Patriots, and I do love Eli Manning because he beat Tom Brady twice. I think one thing that Eli lacked, he didn't have that swagger. He never really carried himself the way you expect a quarterback to carry himself. Like, Eli kind of walked in sort of goofy. He sort of looked like the little brother who was just kind of happy to be there. And then he would just become this monster in the postseason. I think that's really when you measure a guy's greatness, is when the pressure is on and when everyone expects you to perform. He always rose to the occasion. You never believe Eli was going to win the game, but he did.
Well, certainly in the postseason. I mean, it's tough because I admittedly am reading some Boston news sources this week, and they are admittedly biased. But he never led the league in completion percentages, touchdowns, passing yards, yards per game, all those things that you would expect an elite quarterback to lead the league in at least once. He does hold the record for most consecutive starts with a single team, and he is retiring with more career earnings than anyone else in history, at least for a couple of months. So there's that, I guess. I don't know, Charlotte. Are we just like New England sour grapes here?
I mean, I'm not. I think, you know, if you take a team to the Super Bowl twice and perform the way he performed, that warrants greatness. I agree with you, Michael. I think that his sort of lack of charisma, his lack of shine probably played into this, but I kind of think that's Eli being Eli. I love it. You know, there's a famous picture of him at the beach with the dad bod and his in his board shorts carrying like a tiny bucket for one of his kids. And I'm like, give me that guy. Like, that is greatness to me.
I learned this week that there is only one copy of the broadcast of Super Bowl I in existence, and it's sitting in a vault. Okay, so let me explain. The first Super Bowl was broadcast on CBS and NBC, but neither network kept a full copy. Almost four decades later, a man named Troy Hopt found a recording of the game on quadruplex reels, I'm not even quite sure what those are, in his mother's attic in Pennsylvania. Hopt offered to sell the tapes to the NFL or NBC or CBS, but nobody wanted to pay a fair price. And then in 2016, the NFL Network slapped together a bunch of NFL films footage with the remaining snippets of the broadcast, put radio play-by-play over the whole thing, and told fans, that's good enough. Not so, say two filmmakers, and now they're trying to raise $1.5 million on Kickstarter. So what do you say? Contribute to see history or make do with the NFL's make do tape? Michael?
You know, the NFL always finds a way to be on the wrong side of everything. And I think in this case, just take care of the man. You're a multi-billion dollar corporation. Like, you make money hand over fist. Like, it's not going to hurt you to take care of this guy for what he found, and especially to hold on to your history. And when you consider, you know, this being the 100th anniversary and everything with the NFL, it's very simple. Just cut the man a check.
How about you, Charlotte?
I don't know. Like, I don't necessarily want to watch all of Super Bowl I. I feel like the clips and the radio calls are probably enough for me, to be perfectly honest. Like, I don't have any interest in sitting through the entire for Super Bowl, but I think for posterity, yeah, save the tape.
NFL, write the check, man. That's all I got to say.
I think you're right. Okay, Michael, I understand that you want to take us to New Orleans.
I do, but actually I want to take you back to 1998. Ooh. When Lauryn Hill released this great song with Carlos Santana called To Zion. It was an homage to her newborn child. Almost 22 years later, the NBA hasn't really written a song to recognize the debut of rookie Zion Williamson, but there is considerable joy about the arrival of a potentially transformative talent. After a slow start, he went on this three-minute rampage in which he scored 17 straight points for the Pelicans and played so well that Coach Alvin Gentry had to think twice about holding him to this minutes restriction that's in place while he recovers from a knee injury that sidelined him for the first few months. With ratings down and stars such as Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, and John Wall all out with injury, the league could use an injection of life, and Williamson provides hope because he has this incredible mix of moxie, athleticism, basketball intelligence, and he can just really dunk the ball harder than anybody else out there. But he is just 19, and I just wonder if there's too much pressure on this kid and how much is too much hype in this social media age.
I think with Zion, he is such an unbelievable talent. I mean, you watch him play and it's just like he's a different kind of human, you know? Like he can do things that you don't think should be able to be done according to the laws of physics. But, you know, you mentioned the injury minutes restriction, and I think that's something that worries me a little bit. I think at only 19, he could have an incredible career. I hope that the coaches he has and the trainers he has don't get carried away by his greatness just to put his future at risk, I guess.
Yeah. I went online today to read a bunch of articles, and I expected to read about all the fun. And instead, I get people who were actually complaining, like really, really complaining that he was taken out because of this minutes restriction, even though quite clearly you don't leave it up to a 19-year-old as to whether or not his knee is good enough to keep playing. And really, I just want to watch all the highlights of those 3 minutes and 8 seconds. I mean, can't we just kind of focus on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing that that stood out to me was the fact that before those 3 minutes, he didn't do anything that was outside of the team. Mm-hmm. I thought that he played controlled. I thought he played poised. Everybody in the world is waiting to see what he's going to do, how he's going to perform, if he's going to reach this level of hype. And he was not concerned with that.
All right. I know it's only supposed to be 3 stories you should know, but I feel like there's a 4th story this week. Charlotte,
there absolutely is.
Is Paul Rudd as nice as he seems?
Yes. should I...
This is a story I've been waiting on.
Should I just explain what happened?
Sure.
Please do.
I covered the AFC Championship in Kansas City, and I'm waiting to board the plane, and Paul Rudd is in line to get on my plane. And I was like, I want to say hi, but I don't want to be that person. So I didn't in line. I got on the plane, and there's this meme of Paul Rudd that's gone viral from an interview he did on Hot Ones. He sits down, and he says, "Hey, look at us." And the host, Sean Evans, says, "Who would have thought?" And Paul Rudd goes, "Not me." So that went viral, and I tweeted, Paul Rudd is on my flight to Kansas City, and I'm fighting the urge to go up to him and say, "Hey, look at us. Who would have thought?" to see if he'll say, "Not me." And everyone, the tweet starts blowing up. People are replying to the tweet saying, "Do it. You have to do it. He's such a nice guy. He loves the Chiefs." So I felt like if I didn't approach him, I would really be letting everybody down. So
yes, you would have.
Yes.
I got up, walked over to his seat in the middle of the flight, and he's like, "Hello." And he's sitting there with his son. I introduced myself to both of them, and I said, you know, I was going to come over here and say, "Hey, look at us," but I didn't. And he was like, "Cool." He was like, "Thank you for not doing that." And I was like, "No problem." And, you know, I told him I was a writer of Sports Illustrated. I was like, "Anytime you want to talk about the Chiefs, just come find me." And he goes, "Okay." And then after the game, he was in the Chiefs locker room, and he's standing right there. And I was so relieved that he was still there that I just ran up to him. And I said, "Hey, it's me, the girl from the plane." And he gives me this huge hug. He's like, "Oh, my God, hi." And, you know, I look around the Chiefs locker room at the celebration. I said, "Can you believe it?" And he goes, "Hey, look at us. Who would have thought?"
Clearly the story of the week.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
My guests for this week's edition of 3 Stories You Should Know have been Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder and The Athletic's Michael Lee. Thanks, Charlotte. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Karen. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. We had a great time, as always.
I want you to Google female high school quarterback. Go ahead. I'll wait, because you might be surprised by the results. In October, a female quarterback in Florida named Holly Nair threw for a 42-yard touchdown on the very first play of her high school career. The year before that, a female quarterback in Hawaii named Alexandria Buchanan broke her school's 4-year losing streak. But back in the 1980s, varsity female quarterbacks weren't common. In fact, I can only think of one. Only a Game's Jonathan Chang has the story.
Deanna Hansen grew up everywhere. Her dad was a recruiter for the Navy. So her family moved around often to wherever he was stationed, Germany, Japan, the U.S. In 1983, as she was entering high school, Deanna and her family moved to Sigonella, Sicily, a small but very close-knit community. The following summer, Deanna was out playing catch with her friends on the football team when...
They were like, "Wow, Dee, you could throw the football way better than we can. And we think it'd be great if you would try out for the team. You know, we'd have you as a quarterback or a backup quarterback, anything." And when I thought about it, the team was so small that more than half of the guys played both offense and defense. So I figured, well, you know, at least I can go out there and try and help. So I said, "Sure, no problem." And, you know, told my parents that I wanted to play to see if they'd be okay with it. They gave me permission. They checked with the school administration and the folks there. They were good with it. However, they needed to get some regional permission from the Department of Defense-Dependent Schools, and the sports director said, "Absolutely not."
See, at the time, Department of Defense-Dependent Schools banned co-ed competition in athletics. And despite everyone's support, the director in Rota, Spain, refused to make an exception.
Well, interestingly enough, my mom and dad were in a hotel restaurant bar, and one of their friends pointed out a gentleman at the restaurant. He was a U.S. Navy JAG officer, and they introduced my parents to him. My parents gave him, summarized the situation to him, and he asked my parents to go to his office the next day because he was very interested in working the case. He sent a letter to the director of the Department of Defense Schools in Washington, D.C. What happened between the time that he sent that letter and a very short time later, I don't know, but the regional director in Rota then reversed his position and allowed me to play. So I made the team, worked out with the team, and it was difficult. I will say football is certainly not easy sport. And for my frame at the time, I was maybe 135 pounds. There was one time when one of the largest players on our team, we were scrimmaging and he caught a pass. And I was playing defense at that time and literally grabbed onto his legs and held on for about 30 to 40 yards while he drug me across the field. And the guys were laughing. They were like, they had no idea who was going to fall first. Their bets were on the fact that he was ultimately going to fall because I was not giving up. So the first game we played against Vicenza, the team was probably at least twice our size in body as well as number of players. So it was a little scary for a first-time player to go out there and know that these guys were that big. But I was excited about it. I wanted to go out and play. Unfortunately, our starting quarterback at the time had his arm broken within the first half. So that meant I got to go out on the field and play the second half of the game. The first snap, I think I almost fumbled the ball because I was so nervous, but I was able to complete several passes. We actually got a touchdown right at the end of that half. So I don't know if the coach was joking or not, but at the end of the game, he said, you got offensive player of the game there, Deanna. Really nice job.
With Sigonella's starting quarterback still injured, Deanna was expected to start the next game against Naples. It was a familiar place for her. She had made a few friends in the area while playing other sports, but
as our bus came through, several of these girls stopped the bus and they said, hey, look, the football team, the guys aren't very happy that Deanna's playing. So, I mean, they're out to get her. I mean, they want to hurt her. So needless to say, the team met that night, and the next day we all ran out there with helmets on our head. That way they weren't able to go, okay, who's the girl? I played for probably a good first quarter or so, and before the end of the first half, I was injured pretty significantly on a late hit, a cheap shot, if you will. There's two, three guys piled on and knocked my shoulder out of socket, knocked it back in, and literally knocked it back out all in just one play. So they weren't kidding when they said, we're going to get the girl.
Deanna had to sit out the rest of the football season with her shoulder injury, but she did get better.
The season after, I was playing basketball, and a couple of the guys from that team came up to me and apologized and said, hey, look, it went too far, you know. And that meant a lot that they actually did walk up and say that to me.
Even though she played only two games, Deanna says she still feels the lasting effects of her time on the gridiron. If you could go back to that day on the field, you know, throwing the football around with your friends, would you choose to play football again?
Knowing what I know now, I don't think I would, because I know what it did to me physically to compete against other teams that were literally twice our size. I think it's important for any young athlete, whether it's a male or a female, to know what your physical limitations and abilities are and make that decision. We shouldn't just do what we think we can. We should really look at the overall situation. Building that team, friendship, bond, it was a great experience. But again, looking back, is my shoulder the way it is today, potentially because of that? I'm sure it probably had a little bit to do with it.
That story came from Only a Game's Jonathan Chang. Deanna Hansen moved back to the U.S. in 1985. She says while she still enjoys watching football, she hasn't played the sport since her time at Sigonella. I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, Super Bowl Haiku 26. Submissions have been flooding our inbox, so be sure to get yours in by Monday. But meanwhile, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Speaking of the Super Bowl, it looks like there's not going to be a clear-cut favorite this time around. Betting odds give the Kansas City Chiefs a very slight edge over the San Francisco 49ers. Does this mean we're likely to see a good game?
I think it probably does. I think the Chiefs should be slightly favored. I think one of the things that's pushing the betting line is the fact that nobody's really quite sure what to make of the 49ers yet. Mm-hmm. It's been an amazing turnaround. So I think people are predicting a little bit more defense than you might expect, given the fact that Patrick Mahomes is in the game.
Right. Well, we knew that Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes was a multi-sport athlete through high school and into college. But this week, his high school football coach made the case, with some help from Yahoo Sports' Dan Wetzel, that Mahomes is as good as he is because of all the different sports and all the different positions he played. And it's a pretty solid argument, don't you think?
I've always felt that way. You know, there are certain people in the world who, if you show them a musical instrument, they can play it in half an hour. There are certain people in the world who, if you hand them a ball, they will learn how to play whatever game you want them to play instinctively. And I think that he's certainly one of the people who's managed to integrate the skills of a number of sports into the ability to play quarterback. He's the first quarterback I ever saw through no-look passes.
Right. Well, so his high school coach says he perfected his sidearm throws on the pitcher's mound. His no-look passes and his hip shakes were learned on the basketball court. His ability to read defenses comes from the season he spent playing safety because his high school had a more experienced quarterback. I wonder how much better he could have been if he had played ice hockey.
Well, we all know he would have become even a more superior human being because that's exactly what happens when anybody plays ice hockey.
Charlie, I'm happy to report that despite what you might have read on Twitter, players will not be transported by boat across the fountains of Bellagio after Commissioner Goodell calls their names in April's NFL draft. No, they will only be transported by boat across the fountains of Bellagio to the red carpet. So I guess that's less ridiculous.
You know, just when you think the NFL draft couldn't become huger and more corny,
yeah,
they've managed to do it.
Dematha Catholic High School coach Morgan Wooten died this week at the age of 88. Wooten was the first person who coached exclusively at the high school level to be inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. He coached at least a dozen players who made it to the NBA. That's quite a legacy, don't you think?
Oh, it absolutely is. And of course, he's pretty much the last of that generation of high school coaches. Now the prominent high school coaches all work at like fancy prep schools and Christian academies. But Morgan Wooten stayed at Dematha for as long as he did, and he was I can tell you, having been in Washington all week, this is an enormous story down here. He's a legendary figure.
15-year-old Coco Gauff beat defending champion Naomi Osaka at the Australian Open this week to become the youngest player to beat a top-five opponent in a women's tour-level match since Jennifer Capriati did it in 1991. Osaka responded by saying, quote, "You don't want to lose to a 15-year-old, you know?" Well, yeah.
It's a good thing that Naomi Osaka didn't get involved in, like, swimming or gymnastics. I don't think she would have been able to handle it. No, the Australian Open has really turned things on its head. Serena Williams got beat, too.
Yeah.
The Australian Open is one of those time zone events that I just can't get next to. I mean, all the really great stuff happens about 4 o'clock in the morning.
Well, another great thing happened at the Australian Open. Anyone who didn't already think Rafael Nadal was dreamy got another reason to reconsider this week. After his return of serve hit a ball girl in the head, Nadal rushed to her side to make sure she was okay, gave her a kiss on the cheek, and then spent his post-game chat talking about how brave she was. And I, for one, am going to be cheering for Nadal from now on.
Yeah, Rafa really made a lot of fans with that. And make no mistake, the girl took a pop.
Yeah.
Rafa didn't hit her with a drop shot. Rafa hit her with a full-out return.
Yeah, it was scary. And finally, Charlie, the Florence Freedom of Baseball's Independent Frontier League will be changing its name. The team would like us to know that this is not one of those frivolous name changes. No, this name change is steeped in history. And the new name is?
The Florence Yalls. It's the Yalls, y'all. And why not? I mean, you can just hear the fans. Hey, what are you doing tonight? I don't know. Y'all want to go to the Yalls game, y'all?
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
I don't know if you've noticed this. You probably have. But the news lately has been discouraging. It seems like no matter which side of the U.S. political aisle you're on, you're probably not terribly happy with the way things are going. But I recently talked to a guy who feels pretty differently about this place many of us call home. And maybe, not coincidentally, he's British.
Joey Mellows is my name. I set up a very silly Twitter handle, which is Baseball Brit. And for better or worse, that's how I'm known now.
I'm going to stick to Joey, though, if that's all right.
Yeah, I prefer Joey, Karen, so that'd be lovely. Thank you.
Growing up on the south coast of England, Joey Mellows, the Baseball Brit, didn't know anything about baseball. But he did know that everyone around him seemed to be on the same path. Joey calls it a conveyor belt. Study hard, get good grades, go to university, meet someone you can spend your life with, buy a car, take on a mortgage, have a baby. In 2014, when Joey was approaching 30 years old, he decided to take a job teaching in South Korea. Why?
It was a romance that ended, and I did the perfectly rational thing of moving 5,000 miles to get away from all the bad memories.
About a year later, Joey's parents came out for a visit. Then all three of them flew to Japan to see the cherry blossoms. That's where Joey's next romance began.
I was in a bar in Osaka, and there was a game on the bar television, and there was this huge chap with a big belly. I said to the barman, I said, "Who is this guy?" He said, "Oh, that's CC Sabathia." And I was like, "Oh, crikey." And I said, like, "What sport is this?" And he said, "This is MLB, this is baseball."
Joey asked his hotel concierge, and sure enough, there was a game in Osaka that night. He took his mom and his dad, and he got himself a beer.
You know, growing up in England with soccer, you can't drink a beer in view of the field in your seat. So that was a real novelty.
So other than the ability to drink beer at your seat, what did you like about baseball?
I like the pace. And I know that's not a popular opinion at the moment in particular, but the pace of play, the game took just over 3 hours, I think. And it gave us time to talk. And I'd say, you know, we had some of the best conversations together, you know, possibly for years, whilst we were sat in between innings trying to work out what was going on.
Joey went back on his own the next night to try to understand the game better. And for the next 4 years, while living in Korea, Joey watched MLB games in the morning and Korean games at night, trying to learn everything he could. But to really understand how a love of baseball could completely transform Joey Mellows' life, you have to know one more thing about him. When he was a kid, Joey watched a lot of movies, American movies. And while watching movies like Easy Rider, Joey became fascinated with the idea of taking a road trip across the U.S., seeing the cities and the wide open spaces, talking to the people. And when he discovered baseball, he figured he'd found the perfect excuse to go from place to place. He announced his plans in a video posted to Twitter.
A very good afternoon, everybody. It's all true. I've made a pretty life-changing slash poor decision to quit my job as a teacher in order to attend 162 baseball games in 2019. Born to be
wild. I started in Japan. That was where the Major League Baseball season began between the Oakland Athletics and the Seattle Mariners.
After Japan, Joey flew back to South Korea to see opening day in the Korean League. And then he flew to the U.S., where he hit the open road. He saw major league games, minor league games, college games. He even visited the Field of Dreams movie site.
All right, America. Joey here, Baseball Brit. I'm currently stood in a cornfield somewhere in Iowa, Dyersville, it's called.
Joey had his life savings and 8 months to see 162 games and all 30 Major League ballparks. He didn't have much of a plan. Every few days, he'd sit down and map out where he wanted to go to next.
The one thing I missed the most whilst I was on the road was the ability to access a kettle. You know, because I drink tea every day. I am, you know, there are stereotypes of English people, and I fall into many of them.
Did you ever, I had read that you worried you might have to sleep in the car at some point?
I did, Karen, yeah. I had to do that a couple of times. And the first time I did it, it was bonkers. I'd just driven from Montgomery, Alabama, the Biscuits, I think at the AA level. And I wanted to go there because I just like the name Biscuits. I wanted to get a T-shirt, and I'm just a goof. So I drove 11 hours to get there. It got rained out. I was staying in a shoddy, dreadful hotel. It was depressing as hell. And then the next day, I drove to the Braves, and they'd been in touch to say, "Hey, Joey, like, you know, we heard you coming. Where are you staying tonight?" And I said, "Oh, I'm not staying anywhere. I don't have anywhere to stay. It's too expensive."
The Braves' head of marketing told Joey, "No worries. You can stay at the team hotel for the night."
And he messaged me saying, "It's all paid. You've just got to turn up." And then I got there, and they said, "Hey, like, we need the credit card." So I was like, "Well, I don't have the credit card because the Braves paid for it." So they said, "Well, you're going to have to ring him, and he's going to have to give us the number." And it was like 1 a.m. So I went and drove my car around to a skip in the back of this hotel.
Wait, what's a skip?
A skip's like one of those big things where you dump a load of rubbish that's really trash.
Oh, a dumpster. We would call it a dumpster.
Yeah, like a huge dumpster that you can actually like get in. I slept in the back of the car. I put the seats down and then had an anorak over my head. The worst thing, Karen, is just like as a 34-year-old man, having to urinate around the back of a skip at 1 o'clock in the morning after the Braves have done something very kind to you because you're too scared to ring up their head of marketing.
Joey made it through the night. And as it happens, he'd already been invited to stay at the home of a stranger the next day.
And when I arrived at his house, it was huge. And I asked him, I said, "Hey, what do you do? You've got a lovely house." He said, "Oh, I'm the vice president of the Atlanta Falcons." And I was like, "Is that the NBA team?" He's like, "No, the NFL team." I was like, "Oh, wow." You know, that's what made it so fun, was that you've got to have the rough with the smooth sometimes.
Well, I was going to ask you about the night you spent with the vice president of the Falcons, because it involves some baseball cards, right?
You have really done your research here, Karen.
I really
Jeez,
have.
Wow. Yeah, Mike Egan. I hope Mike doesn't mind me saying his name. And Mindy, his wife, who is absolutely... Mindy gave me a kettle. I was staying above their garage. I drank so much tea whilst I was at their house. It was wonderful. But what was the question?
The baseball cards.
Sorry, I was getting carried away with the tea. Yeah, we went out and watched the Braves game. It was really short. It was over like 2 hours, 38 minutes or something. And we came home and I said to Mike, I was leaving the next day, and he'd mentioned that he had these baseball cards. So I said, "Oh, if it's not too late, go up to the attic and get your baseball cards out." So he ran upstairs and he came down with all these boxes and we were going through them. So I saw this Nolan Ryan rookie card. And because of the Texas Rangers games that I'd watched in Korea with Shin Soo Chu, even I knew about Nolan Ryan. So I was like, "Geez, a rookie card, that's going to be worth some money." So I Googled it and yeah, it's worth $25,000 and it was in prime condition. And Mindy, his wife, came down, and this is about like 1 a.m. and like we're just making all this noise and whooping and, you know, being really excited kids, like looking at these cards in his kitchen. She's like, "Boys, you need to go to bed. Mike, you've got work at 6. But then Mike was like, "No, Mindy, look what Joey's found." And she was like, "Boys, take as long as you want." There were people like Mindy and Mike, kind hearts everywhere I went.
So whenever Joey needed a ticket or a place to stay or a recommendation for where to eat, he'd just ask. I mean, I really feel like for me, that's the part of your story that I find so intriguing, is all the help that you found along the way and all the nice people, because I feel like we're pretty jaded right now as a country. Like, we're not necessarily feeling great about ourselves, but you seem to have had a really wonderful experience here.
I had a wonderful time every day, and that's not to downplay all the politics and things, but in this day and age, Karen, I think, you know, there's so much stuff online in particular that can divert and divide people. And I think, you know, baseball's something really important because it allows people to come together on an almost daily basis.
In June, Joey interrupted his road trip for a flight back home to see the Red Sox and the Yankees play in London. That's where his goal of 162 games and 30 ballparks hit a snag. Joey went out dancing with some friends.
And I just remember dancing and then waking up the next day and my wallet had just, it had gone.
It took 2 weeks for a new driver's license to arrive. When it did, Joey flew back to the U.S. and got back on the road. But that 162-game goal started looking less and less likely.
To begin with, I was desperately trying to find double headers. And I went to a college tournament where they had like 3 games on a day and stayed there for like 2.5 days just to try and rack up the numbers. But there came a point, Karen, where I just thought this trip's been so much more than trying to get to 162 games. Maybe that number is just a silly number anyway.
So on October 1st, after visiting Toronto, his 30th major league ballpark, Joey Mellows arrived back home, 16 games shy of his goal. He'd get invited back to see a World Series game, bringing his total to 147. Now he's working to develop a podcast and is starting his own business, hoping to help grow interest in baseball in the UK.
I had saved up money and I'd planned to spend not all of it, and then I spent all of it. And I'm currently in a lot of debt, but every now and then people would come up to me at a ballpark and say, hey, like, we're really jealous of what you're doing. And I'd kind of look at them and, you know, they'd be with their partner and their children and they'd have a nice car and a home that they're going back to. And I kind of think to myself, geez, like, why are you jealous of me? You've got everything, really. I don't have anything. I don't have a mortgage or a car or a girl or anything like that. But I did have these 8 months on the road and, you know, the opportunities that have come up since then, I could never have imagined. So sometimes I think you've just got to roll the dice and stop waiting for things. And, you know, make things happen.
So looking back, what did you learn from this whole journey? What do you take away from it?
I don't think I learned anything, really. You know, I wish Karen had something deep and meaningful to kind of say, yeah, I found myself, whatever. But I was always a pretty happy guy. And at the end of the day, it's just an idiot watching baseball for a summer.
Maybe we don't need to learn something deep and meaningful from Joey Mellows' journey. Maybe it's enough to be reminded that baseball season is right around the corner. And when it arrives, we can go to the ballpark and sit in our seats and drink a beer and eat peanuts and talk to the people in the seats next to us, even if they don't support the same political candidates we do. And maybe for those next few hours, maybe it will all be okay. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.